Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Beverly Deep Keever, Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Hawaii and author of News Zero, The New York Times, and The Bomb. Professor Keever's remarks were given as the 2014 Distinguished Lecture, presented annually by the Asian World Center and by the Department of Journalism, Media, and Computing at Creighton University. The topic of her presentation will be Death Zones and Darling Spies, 7 years of Vietnam War Reporting. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, March 4th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Eileen Wirth, Chairman of the Department of Journalism, Media, and Computing at Creighton University.
Bev graduated from the University of Nebraska College, was in School of Journalism. She got her master's degree at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and learned a technique of research to find out how people were feeling. As a child growing up in Belvidere, Nebraska, which is a suburb of Hebron, which is a suburb of Beatrice, or Fairbury, she had become utterly fascinated with China by reading Pearl Buck's The Good Earth, and she was obsessed with visiting China. So after she graduated from got her master's, she took an around-the-world steamer to China, the kind of the slow boat. But at the time, the United States pretended China didn't exist, so she couldn't get off in Shanghai. So then she headed to Vietnam, where she had been told that the action was, and thus began her adventure and her distinguished career of reporting for a number of publications, including the old New York Herald Tribune, Newsweek, and the Christian Science Monitor. She covered many of the major battles. At the time, one little anecdote that's kind of fun, the Army insisted on that women reporters have escorts. One of her escorts was a handsome Marine who she's been married to now for 45 years. So anyway, with that, I'm going to let you turn this over to Bev. Let her tell you her own story. She is a delight. One of the students who heard her in one of our journalism classes yesterday, it was in my class, came up to me after class and says, "Dr. Wirth, your friend's presentation was wonderful. It was so inspiring." So Bev, you've got a larger crowd to inspire. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I am so honored and pleased to be here, even though I was born in Nebraska near Hebron and went to the university in Lincoln. This is the first time I've spent much time in Omaha and absolutely the very first time I've been to Creighton University. So it's a real privilege to be here. And also to see what a lovely and big, spacious, student-friendly campus it is. People tell me it's even better in the summer. But anyhow, I am so pleased to be here for the very, very first time. Well, there's been a lot of media attention recently on John F. Kennedy and the assassination of him 50 years ago this past November was a lot of flashbacks for all of us. Undoubtedly, one of President Kennedy's most fateful decisions related to Vietnam. It was a decision that was to lead calling up hundreds of young men who were drafted. So many of you, if you'd been in that era, would probably be putting on GI Green. I arrived in Vietnam just as Kennedy's decision was beginning to unfold, when he increased the number of U.S. servicemen in Vietnam, thus breaking an international agreement made at the 1954 Geneva peace talks on French Indochina, and he introduced the U.S. support units, especially the helicopter units, which became the one that most people really identify with the war. So I arrived there in February 1962 and stayed there for 7 years. I had planned to stay for only 2 weeks, and things just got bigger and bigger all the time. my first apartment that I lived in. It was pretty austere. It was concrete floors. It was cotton slipcovers on bamboo furniture. And there was no water that was safe to drink throughout the city. Even the best hotels, you had to boil your water or put in a pill. And my maid had to go to the market every day to get fresh produce because there was no refrigeration. It was also about 2 blocks from the presidential palace. Well, after I'd been here about 2 or 3 weeks, there were airplanes that came in and bombed the presidential palace. These were not enemy airplanes. These were his own Air Force pilots who were disenchanted with the regime. So that was my first real journalistic lesson that you don't learn in textbooks. You not only had to get the story, you had to get it out of the country, because the first thing the government did on something like that was to close the cable office where you could transmit the news from Saigon. But fortunately, there was a Time magazine correspondent who was smart to that. The first thing he did is he picked up the telephone and got a Saigon dateline to tell about the bombing of the palace. And after that, nobody else got the news out for days. So he was a guinea pig that showed the way for me, getting this story out of the cable office and into the world. Unless you were on the spot where you were disseminating the news, you couldn't use the dateline. So the Saigon dateline prevailed there. A year later, this place, when we had the coup against that president for real and toppled him, the place was looted. They didn't bother to take my Western dresses, but they scooped up all of my maid's Vietnamese dresses and so on. And about a year later, I was evicted from this place and went to a place that was actually much more closer to the cable office. When I first got there, Saigon was very much of a Frenchified city. It was very shady in most of the streets, and they would be selling flowers along some of the main thoroughfares and so on. So it was a beautiful city. And not too many private automobiles, but there were little taxis, Renault taxis, that I took around town. But this was my favorite way to get around town, with these kind of rickshaws and pedals. As I said, the first 6 months that I was there, I was a freelancer, and so I could travel around the country, no deadlines, no schedules, actually nobody to even tell me what I was supposed to be writing about. In a way, this was my most educational period, because it was an entirely Vietnamese show. I felt that I was seeing, you know, how Vietnam was before the American buildup and the presence became so pronounced. I interviewed about really interesting people at this time. There were only 8 Western correspondents in Saigon at that time, and most of them were wire service guys, and of course they were all guys, that could not really leave their office uncovered. They had to cover the government and big announcements. And so I wrote about things that were interesting, but they didn't have time to cover. And one of them was this fabulous nurse who had been sent to the jungled areas that she was treating what they call the hill people or the mountain yards in the jungle. And she would tell me about how they would come in with these really incredible diseases flocking to her little pink dispensary. Another interesting woman that I tracked down and wrote about was a major, Anne Doring, who had been born in Haiphong. She was by now a WAC in Vietnam and the only American woman in the service in Vietnam. So I wrote about her. And overall, there were about 8,000 to 11,000 American women that were assigned to Vietnam over the period of the year, most of the war. And most of these were nurses, and most of them were in the coastal city of Nha Trang. So these were the kind of stories that I could do as a freelancer. And it was a really flexible time that you kind of scouted out. Of course, you never knew if you were going to sell the story. But AP was very generous in running most of these stories that I did send them. My first big operation that I went on outside of Saigon was to a liberated zone. It was only 30 miles from Saigon, but by truck you had to go in. And the communists had held this area under the French, and they were still dug in very much in that area under the Saigon government. So only 30 miles from Saigon, the government still, in effect, had given some of the territory and the government over to what we called then the Viet Cong or the communists. So this was a little patrol that I went with the American Ranger advisors in this training camp to sort of build up the Vietnamese Ranger units. And on this patrol, it was kind of shadows and moonlight and rough roads and paths, and I was kind of ducking around, and this one GI said to me, "Oh, don't worry about it. You never hear the bullet that gets you." So after that, I never worried about being killed. I did worry about getting wounded and being a burden to my family or something. In all of this, of course, I had no health insurance of any kind, no life insurance. So it was a big risk for my family, too. Now, as Eileen mentioned, I had this job in New York where I was doing grassroots doorbell ringing interviewing for a syndicated columnist named Samuel Lubell. He had won a Guggenheim and published this book, The Future of American Politics. And this book was translated into six languages, including Korean. I think you used it in your poli-sci classes in the old days. Anyhow, the trick was, what were the trends, the political trends, and why did people shift from one like Eisenhower to Kennedy? We looked at the Truman to Eisenhower shift. Why did people shift as the country shifted? We were very precise in picking what we called barometer precincts, and then good old shoe leather journalism, go out and interview. He felt you had to go to the spot that shifted in order to get the real facts, not just big statistical databases. Anyhow, that's kind of what I wanted to do in Vietnam. I wanted to know, how did the communists get this appeal to the masses out there in the rice paddies and in the countryside? And it was, of course, the guerrillas and their sales pitch that ended up defeating a superpower by that point. So I wanted to try to understand what Mao Zedong and the Vietnamese called the People's War. So this was the chapter that I found most intriguing, because I had done a lot of interviewing with defectors and prisoners and asking this question, and this was the first time that I saw face-to-face some of the people that were really doing it. These films were taken from an undeveloped roll of film on a dead Viet Cong soldier that an American soldier had taken after the battle, and he gave it to my friend and photographer colleague, Jim Pickrell. So when I got these photos from Jim, I decided, you know, this kind of put a face on what the Americans called their enemy, and I felt this was the part of the war that the American reading public probably knew the least about. Even though they knew about the guerrillas, they didn't really know why did the guerrillas fight as they did. So it turns out, in identifying why they did do that among the various sources, there were several reasons. One is the communists remembered that the Americans had backed the French heavily in the French Indochina War. So their propaganda was always that we were just a disguised colonial regime following in the French footsteps. So this is what the masses were told, you know, even though the French were long gone. And even the American ambassador Taylor, who was a general, kind of agreed that the Americans were misplaced in Vietnam. He was opposed to the combat troop buildup, even when he was an ambassador. And he was the general that advised President Kennedy on a lot of the counterinsurgency. And he argued that the white-faced soldier cannot be assimilated by the population. He cannot distinguish friendly from unfriendly Vietnamese. But more than that, the communists had a really important message in their own right. One is they promised the landless people land. Now, the Southerners didn't know that North Vietnamese, once they took control by the communists, had a very disastrous land reform program in the North. But they still promised that to the Southerners. And, of course, most of the people in the farming areas were tenant farmers. So that had a lot of residents. They also had social clubs that they organized. Some of them were kind of like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, and he said they would sit around the campfire and sing songs just like, you know, it was fun. It was exhilarating to be a young person in the communist movement, even though there were a lot of hardships and it was very tough physically. But then the communists also used intimidation and terrorism, but they were very selective, not just mass bombings and so on. I get the feeling is happening in Afghanistan. They would make it quite clear why this village chief or why this office was targeted. And they were especially good at targeting the big American, like, billets and so on in various places throughout the country. So people knew why the terrorism was taking place. The communists believed that it was a cheap shot and counterproductive to just have random terrorism. But they were very selective, and they used it judiciously. So the women were very much swept up into this. They became very important. Often they would kind of suggest or persuade their buddies or their husbands or their friends to go join the Viet Cong. And the women also did important activities like tipping off the intelligence and, of course, keeping the rice production going and so on. So they really captivated the population. Now, you may wonder about the Darling Spies in the title of my book. This was my assistant, Francois Nguyen. He was really a great person. He spoke fluent French and English and, of course, Vietnamese. He had studied journalism in Orange County, California. He was on the student paper, and he loved it. He loved it. But as a teenager, he, like his buddies in high school, they joined the Viet Minh to fight the French, to get the French kicked out. So when he came back from California, he said, well, we still got a colonial regime, and the Americans are no different than the French. So he continued ending up being an ace spy for Hanoi. And he operated alone. I had no idea. He worked for me, actually the New York Herald Tribune, from 64 until I left, 5 years. And very easygoing guy. Also very well informed. During this time, he gave me the carbons of some manuscript he typed out. Mao Zedong's choice sayings on guerrilla warfare. And Mao identifies 5 kinds of spies. And An wasn't a very good typist, X's. So An has in this manuscript, Darling Spies. I looked all over the web. There's a lot of Mao on the web. but no Darling Spies. And I showed it to my buddy, prof over in American Studies, and he looked on the web, and he couldn't find it either. And I thought, you know, I wonder if this is legit. So I went to a academic journal that had an article by a American military analyst and so on Mao, and I found the real quote. Mao had said, "Daring spies." So I thought, well, An was kind of like a darling spy in that the definition was somebody who serves both sides at great risk to themselves. So now the odd thing was An was paid by the New York Herald Tribune and other publications that I worked for, but his buddy, Win Hu Vuong, who was older and thinner, I paid for him out of my own pocket because he was so, they were buddies. But more than that, Vuong spoke French, English, and read and write Chinese. He had been the son of a Vietnamese functionary who grew up in China and knew Chinese. So anyhow, the two of them would be arguing what Hanoi Radio was saying, what the communists were going to come up with, all of this. So I really had, later I found out Vuong was working for the CIA back to World War II when they were trying to find the downed pilots in China and so on. So he'd been on the CIA payroll for a long time too. So I had spies on both sides of me, completely unknown to me. And I don't think it affected my copy at all because, if anything, it kind of balanced out. Anyhow, I'm sorry to say both of those are gone now, but An has had television broadcasts and books written about him. The New Yorker had a series, and that author wrote a book about him, The Spy Who Loved Us. And there's a prof in California that is now making a movie out of this. And, of course, Vietnamese television has already made a serial out of the whole. They made a great hero out of An. But, in fact, he was pretty influential. He was getting access to some of the American plans before the Americans even got the logistics in there to carry them out. It was really phenomenal. Anyhow, that was the background, sort of the Saigon era. Once the American support units came in, the main ones that were really helpful for journalists were the helicopter units. And they were also some of our best sources because, of course, they were going where the action was. This allowed the journalists to, flip around the country on a space-available basis whenever there was action in some little isolated place or some battle somewhere. I just kind of went in on a fluke to this place called Cam Duc, where the government was setting up a brand new kind of fortress to pull the hill people in from the jungle areas so they could not help the Viet Cong with intelligence or with food or with portage and so on. And they were going to pull them all into this kind of strategic hamlet program. Then they had new airplanes with loudspeakers. Everyone that isn't out of the jungle, we're going to bomb it. So come into the government area so we can protect you. So one of the province chiefs that I went with on one of these operations said, we tell them, this is going to be a death zone if you don't leave the communist area and come over to safety on the government side. So I think I may have been the first one to use the exact phrase death zones very early in the war. Later on, of course, the Pentagon sanitized it to something like free fall zones. But frankly, they would just come in and bomb these areas that they suspected no one lived in, but they never sent out any ground troops to verify if any civilian casualties had been hit or what happened or not. Now, this was an example of the strategic hamlets and the forts that were really scattered in time all over the jungled areas because President Kennedy thought the thing that would allow the Americans to win when the French didn't was the helicopter and the special forces. So if you remember the Green Berets and so on, well, they were operating in these forts, training these hill people to be the fighters and to go out and check the infiltration and so on. So there were maybe about 100 of these over time that were built. By the time I left in 7 years, they had all either been evacuated, withdrawn, or overrun. Now, many times these hill people that did the being trained had their families with them. So sometimes not all of them got out if they were being attacked and overrun. So, of course, they were pretty isolated. And in time, the big units and even heavy firepower on the communist side could come in and really just pick them off one by one. I've also looked at some of the fortifications that they're using for these in Afghanistan. And to me, it's just a repeat pattern. They're isolated up on these hilltops. And, you know, there's big stories when they're very close to overrun and very few of the guys get out. So these are sort of one of the ways that I think there's a repeat in some of the aspects of Vietnam. And now, this was one of the most interesting interviews that I had. This is a North Vietnamese private that was captured. And I was able to interview him, Private Le Phung Ham. This was right before the 1964 election. Of course, the American government had always said, this is a war of aggression from North Vietnam into anti-communist South Vietnam. But they had never shown anyone, specifically a North Vietnamese that they had captured or that had defected in the South. Many of the people had come from the South, gone to the North in 1954, and then were re-infiltrated, and they were some of the support elements for the insurgency against the government. But they were basically Southerners who kind of made this round trip. But this was the first one that had been captured. And the interesting thing is he said he came in with a North Vietnamese unit. So we wrote this story, and I had both Vietnamese and American senior military people confirming, yes, there were these North Vietnamese units coming in across the demilitarized zone. So I interviewed this young man, and Vung, my interpreter, was a northerner. Well, the first that this young man opened his mouth, he could tell by the accent that he also was a northerner. So I wrote the story that North Vietnamese units were coming into the South. Well, before the election, Johnson was not eager to, in effect, show that the North Vietnamese were coming in because the Americans were not in a position to react in any significant way. So the Pentagon denied my story. But later on, then they started to beef up why they had to send in combat troops and so on. And it turned out that my story was very accurate. And the Pentagon's papers indicate, too, that the Pentagon fudged the figures until after the election. And it was a good example of news management. President Zam, he was in the United States at the time of the 1954 Geneva Conventions that ended the French Indochina War. But Eisenhower did not want the French to come back to Indochina, and they did not want the communists to take over Vietnam. So the deal was they split the country, and they were supposed to have elections in 1955. Well, even Eisenhower is on record saying, if we have an election, Ho Chi Minh is going to win by 80%. So they somehow finessed the election, and all at once, President Zam was the president. Anyhow, he was a Catholic, but most of the Vietnamese were basically Confucianist. on, you know, in the real core values. But his brother had been killed by the communists, and he was fervently anti-communist. So anyhow, even under Eisenhower, they started backing them. And then he had met Kennedy, Mansfield, some of the biggies in Washington. They started supporting him more and more. Kennedy then started the troop buildup and so on. Anyhow, they, the side door, kind of the sneaking way when you cannot have any military power per se, is student or religious protests. So on May 8th, you began the urban upheaval. Instead of just insurgency and infiltration, you now have urban upheaval in the cities. And this was an example of the Buddhists who were demonstrating, having five demands against the Catholic president, said they were suffering oppression and so on. At the time that this started, I was in the hospital with hepatitis, which I had contacted from contaminated food and water in Vietnam, and I'd almost been in Laos. So I wasn't on top of that story at all. But in June, this Buddhist monk, an elderly monk, Thich Quang Duc, I interviewed him about 2 days before he threatened to burn himself alive, and 2 days before he did it, and he was really a very placid, dedicated, sedate, elderly man. And 2 days later, they made sure that the AP correspondent was there with a good camera. And this was one of the most explosive story photos ever, I think. President Kennedy was talking to Robert Kennedy, the attorney general at the time, when he saw this photo, and he said, "Oh my God!" You know, an expletive deleted. And then he later said that this was one of the most momentous photographs, news photographs in history. So this photo really caught the attention of the Kennedy administration, but the whole country. I mean, they got Peter Arnett and the AP Bureau got telegrams from all over the world, and people interpreted it much different ways, but it was, I think, a decisive moment in the war. And it was one of the factors, as it snowballed and so on, that led to the Americans cutting off their support for the Zem government and really giving the green light for a coup d'etat. So November 1, just 50 years ago, this past November, the Zem government fell. And then 22 days later, President Kennedy was assassinated. So that was a momentous autumn. And after Zem fell, the Buddhists and others wiped out the regime, secret police. They had secret militia and a big network of supporters and so on. And so the government was just non-existent. It deteriorated so fast that in 64, with all the changes in government and the communists were coming closer and closer to Saigon, I got a big kind of metal footlocker, and I put my best dresses and some books in there, and I might have to make a fast exit from here. So I was prepared to leave the country because we didn't know what was going to happen. And at the same time, de Gaulle was suggesting a neutralist coalition. Well, of course, we know Johnson did not do that. Instead, he sent in the combat troops, not just support units that could operate to support the Vietnamese. This was the 173rd Airborne, which was the strategic reserve for the Americans based in the Pacific. They sent them in first in this D-zone area, not too far where I had that my first patrol. And These were the first combat units. Notice how young they are. These were the draftees. They were the ones that were not lucky enough to go to graduate school, or some people, of course, they fled to Canada to avoid going to Vietnam. But anyhow, Hanoi called this the Teenage Brigade, and frankly, I think that's the age group most of them were in. They were always amazed to see me and wondered, what was I doing there, and so on. And I said, you know, I can leave any time, you can't, but I'm here to tell your story. So then they, you know, understood, well, maybe it was, this actually turned out to be one of the first offensive operations since the Korean War by this unit that they soon went on. When the American units came in, they brought with them tremendous firepower, artillery, big helicopters with much bigger machine guns on them, and always supported, you know, long range with bombers and so on. The intensity of the fighting grew, and unbelievably, it also became much more dangerous for journalists. Dickie Chappelle was the most experienced combat correspondent in Vietnam, a woman who'd also been in World War I, World War II and Okinawa with the Marines. She'd been with the Marines in Lebanon, and she was with Marines in 1966 on just a kind of little routine patrol, killed by a landmine. So Vietnam was a very dangerous war for journalists, and it was also a war in which television was just coming in, and they started the first televised war. The first newscast from the networks expanded from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. And so they tell the story that Johnson White House had three television sets in the White House, and he watched all three network news broadcasts at the same time because Vietnam had started to captivate people and mystify them. And actually, politically, it became more and more controversial. And, of course, as the young men were getting closer to their draft numbers and so on, they started more student protests and other protests, too. And, of course, the real casualties that we don't have a good number on were the civilian casualties in Vietnam. So many people were killed and wounded and misplaced and forced to relocate and so on. So this was one of the tragedies that I don't think is fully appreciated. And there are really no exact numbers. I think McNamara asked the North Vietnamese how many troops they lost. They didn't really know, but it was in the millions on the North Vietnamese side. Well, if you remember at all, in the 1967, as we were approaching the 1968 election, President Johnson called back the leading American General Westmoreland and the American Ambassador Bunker to give a pep talk to the population. They went before Congress to address and television broadcasts and, oh, we're winning the war. And the general even said, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, it was a lot of optimism that Johnson was trying to build up before the election. On January, end of January, you had what is called the Lunar New Year for the Vietnamese. And as the tradition was, they had a ceasefire so that all the Vietnamese on both sides could go home to their families. So many of the Vietnamese on the government side did go back to the countryside, to their families. And we thought that the Viet Cong was going to take some sort of a ceasefire, too. Well, instead, they launched a general offensive, which meant an offensive across the whole country. They hit many of the provincial capitals, and they hit not only the American Embassy in Saigon, but mainly many of the key points, including the first thing they always capture is the radio station and the Navy Yard, where they had boats that were pro-Zam and so on. They also captured the city of Wei for 26 days. But in order to sort of get on top and defeat the communists, the Americans and the South Vietnamese forces often had to call in firepower, planes, and artillery on their own troops, on their own compounds, even in their friendly villages. This is the Zaloy Pagoda, which was the headquarters of the Buddhist headquarters for the demonstrations trying to get rid of the Zam government. And also, the government suspected that the communists had taken over command of this pagoda. So in order to rectify it, the government, I don't know if South Vietnamese or American planes, had bombed the neighborhood all around this major pagoda. And this also occurred in the provincial capitals. I went to Ben Hoa, which was about 30 miles from Saigon, which was a major headquarters for American logistics. And the communists were in the provincial capital, and they had to bomb even the housing of some of the Vietnamese troops' families and some of the areas that were always, you know, pro-government. And that's the only way they got rid of the communists. In Ben Tre, the AP reporter went down there, and they had to do the same thing. Communists had overrun almost everything except the military compound and the provincial headquarters, and they called in artillery, even on their neighbors' homes. And the American major said to Peter Arnett, "We had to destroy the town to save it." It became one of the most damaging quotes ever for the American policy. And Peter said in his story, it shows the dilemma of the American position here in Vietnam. You know, this tremendous firepower, but look at what you destroy and how you, in effect, turn people against you. Even in my place in Saigon, you could hear gunfire all over the streets. There were bombing air raids across the river. And so during this Tet Offensive, I wrote for the Christian Science Monitor. For the first time, there was a real possibility that the Americans might lose this war. So not for sure, but, you know, it's really a display of the vulnerability of American power. And that story was picked up by the Columbia Journalism School that was celebrating its centennial year last year as one of the 50 top stories written by a Columbia alum in the past century. So I even forgot I made that prediction. It was pretty iffy, but I did say it pretty loud and clear. You know, this is not the way that you're going to win a war. Now, as I mentioned, that the communists, actually North Vietnamese, just came across the demilitarized zone and captured the city of Hue. They just marched their battalions straight down the main street of Hue. Hue was the cultural center of Vietnam. It was the old imperial capital, and it had a miniature Forbidden City. Well, the Marines had to fight house to house and block by block to get them dislodged from Hue. I went in there as the about the 20th day. The communists held it for 26 days. And I landed right behind these Marine lines. It was one of the scariest things because the helicopter came in. It was no level place to really land. He just kind of touched his foot down, and it was misty. The gunfire was having smoke all over. And I said, I don't know if I should have done this one or not. But anyhow, I hopped out behind the Marine lines, and he just went almost house to house and street by street before they could clear the communists out of Hue. I met one old American sergeant who'd been in the Korean War. He said, this is so much worse than the Korean War in Seoul. Because in Seoul, both armies marched through the city, but they didn't fight house to house through it like we did here. So Wei was pretty much decimated. And then later on, they found a mass grave while the North Vietnamese were holding and controlling the city. They had targeted individuals, mostly government officials or government sympathizers, that they picked up and massacred, had a mass grave, and they discovered this about 3 or 4 months later. So Wei was a major, major loss. Now, the reason that Wei was so poorly defended is that many of the American units and some Vietnamese were actually up in the border area at Khe Sanh. General Westmoreland and President Johnson were so afraid that the communists were going to attack Khe Sanh and make it the Dien Bien Phu that had led to the French defeat. President Johnson even had a sandbox replica of Khe Sanh in the basement of the White House. And so they were really preparing for kind of a major repeat of the French experience. Instead, the communists pulled their forces over to the urban centers, and that's how they could capture the provincial capitals, and in this case, Wei. So I waited to fly into Khe Sanh while the battles were still going on after Wei. In the hangar, there was a couple of other journalists with me. One was Sean Flynn. He was the son of the movie star, Errol Flynn, a good photographer. Well, later on, he went to Cambodia, and they've never found his body since. We assume that he's been killed, along with other correspondents. Just as we were waiting there to get on board, they brought the body out of Robert Ellison. He was a photographer that I had worked with on other stories. Very, very young guy, very talented. He got some fantastic photos of Khe Sanh under fire and so on. Later, it was the Newsweek cover and so on, but he was gone. So it was a pretty dicey time for them. At Khe Sanh, the shelling was occurring about every minute. The neat thing for the communists was they had artillery on the other side of the border in Laos, dug into the mountainsides so they could aim their artillery, pinpoint it at Khe Sanh, and then pull their artillery back. And one of the officers said, you know, they have every place on this camp targeted. They can hit us, but we cannot hit them. Even though the Americans pulled in B-52s that ordinarily, out of Omaha, fly, the SAC bombers, the B-52s, they were dumping hundreds of payloads in these areas, sometimes even as close as 1,000 yards from the camp, the American camp itself, even though the safety margin is 3,000 yards. Anyhow, they could not dislodge the North Vietnamese shelling, even under heavy bombardment. Well, eventually, the communists withdrew, and the fighting died down around Khe Sanh. And one of the young Marines with the 26th Regiment said, if nothing else was gained by the Vietnamese experience, let it at least be a warning not to ever, ever let it happen again. So that was early 1968. As I was leaving Khe Sanh, President Johnson made a startling announcement on March 1st, 1968. One, he would not seek re-election. And second, he would begin a bombing halt to start the peace talks, which had been the communists' condition in order to even start talking peace. Then shortly later on October 31st, Johnson ordered a complete bombing halt and said that the peace talks would start in Paris on November 6th, which was a day after the American election in 1968. During that time, of course, the Saigon government kind of knew from what Humphrey was talking. He was the candidate to replace Johnson and the vice president, inheriting the Vietnam War from Johnson. He had already started to talk about a coalition government. Well, the South Vietnamese government had fought the communists so long they didn't want a coalition government because they thought over time they would end up controlling the country. Anyhow, a complete bombshell, the South Vietnamese president said, "We're not going to Paris like the president wanted." And so that kind of scuttled the idea that Humphrey would be able to save the election and so on. So the question was, well, why wasn't President Thieu from Saigon go to talk peace? At that point, I wrote a story that the reason they wouldn't go is because Nixon, who was running against Humphrey, said, don't rush to Paris. When I get to be president, I'll give you a better deal. In other words, everyone knew Nixon was pretty hardline anti-communist. And he also had good information through Anna Chenault and other people that were a direct line to President Thieu. So I wrote the Christian Science Monitor that the reason Saigon was not going right before the election was because of Nixon. Well, the editor said, we can't confirm that story, so we can't run it. And he said, to run that story without a confirmation would be virtual equivalent of treason. Little did he know at the time that President Johnson was saying the same thing because he was tapping the lines of the Saigon embassy, and he knew what was going on with the communication between Nixon and Saigon. And so, to my surprise, as I was writing my book, I had researched some of this through the memoirs, but I did not know that the Monitor had sent their Washington correspondent to the Saigon embassy to get a confirmation of what Nixon was doing, or Nixon's people were doing, to stave off the peace talks. And they didn't get anything from the Saigon people. So then they went to the White House, and Rostow and Dean Rusk were there, and Johnson was at the LBJ Ranch, and so they telegraphed him. And he saw my lead about Nixon's purported encouragement for Thieu not to go to the peace talks at this time. So there was a big powwow about what they're going to say publicly. It was right before the election. They chose to say nothing. They could have discounted it, they could have confirmed it, or they could have disclosed what Nixon was doing. But they thought among these top leaders, it would be more damaging for the whole government to acknowledge this, in effect, double cross than to either confirm my story or to blow the whistle on Nixon. Anyhow, they did nothing. But they do know now that all of this took place. There's a fabulous autobiography by Anna Chenault, who discloses all the time she went to see Nixon and also John Mitchell, who was the campaign manager. And so because of that, I wrote this final part of my book, which was picked up in this magazine that's devoted to Vietnam, on the unexploded bombshell right before the election. And I really think that history would have been different in Vietnam if Nixon had not been elected. Nixon assumed, I think, that he could make a deal with the communists, but they were holding tight. You know, they didn't have to really negotiate much. I am sure Humphrey would never have invaded Cambodia and Laos and expanded the war. And the war actually intensified and expanded a lot with the peace president coming in with Nixon. Anyhow, this was just this excerpt from my book was just picked up by this magazine. Economics professor Robert Collins has called 1968 as the year the American century came to an end. And I really think this was the beginning of the decline of the American prestige and power and belief in themselves. He argued that an economic crisis caused by the Vietnam War and the Great Society programs created a run on the dollar and the gold that both revealed and contributed to the passing of post-war U.S. economic hegemony. I think that was the major, major turning point for the United States. And the next year I left Vietnam just as Richard Nixon was entering the White House. After that, the war intensified, spread to Laos and Cambodia, and led to the American withdrawal. So, 2 years later, Hanoi took over, you know, in 1965. So, thank you very much for your attention and this flashback to history that I'm sorry to see is kind of some parallels that we might be experiencing as we bring our troops back from Afghanistan, deciding how many we're going to leave there, if any. And I think while we overthrew the ZEM regime, President Karzai in Afghanistan has reversed the roles here. He's kind of got the Americans in a position where they've got to do a lot of negotiating. I also see some parallels at a different level between the death zones that I describe and the very targeted drone attacks. Theoretically, they are more precise, but they're still, you know, bombs from the heavens, and you're not always sure of exactly who the enemy is that's being hit. Anyhow, I will try to answer any questions if you have any. Coming in.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Beverly Deep Keever, Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Hawaii and author of News Zero, The New York Times and the Bomb. Professor Keever spoke on the topic, Death Zones and Darling Spies, 7 years of Vietnam War Reporting. Her remarks were given as the 2014 Distinguished Lecture, presented annually by the Asian World Center and by the Department of Journalism, Media, and Computing at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, March 4th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Maorong Jang, Director of Creighton's Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.